Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and some of you may remember we had Boston University law professor Jay Wexler on the show in July to talk about the theory that a clause in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution would allow the president to unilaterally raise the debt ceiling without congressional action. That turned out to be unnecessary, but Jay Wexler now has a whole book on clauses like that one. It's called The Odd Clauses, Understanding the Constitution Through 10 of Its Most Curious Provisions. Professor Wexler, welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
And we tend to venerate the Constitution. You know, the Tea Party kind of says, oh, we're all about upholding the Constitution. People will say that on the left, too. Congress opened its session by reading the entirety of the Constitution, except the clauses they decided to omit, like when it empowered slavery. Is it sacrilegious to call any of its clauses odd?
I don't think so. I mean, it's true that to the framers of the Constitution, none of the clauses were odd. That's true. They thought that all of the clauses were important. They put them all in there for a reason. But some of them now seem a little odd, I think, to us as we look at them. They're things that we don't use very often or that we don't hear about very much or that seem kind of antiquated. But nonetheless, there's nothing by calling them odd, I certainly don't mean to imply that they're unimportant.
And we're going to get into many in your list of 10, which are the Incompatibility Clause, the Weights and Measures Clause, Recess Appointments Clause, the Original Jurisdiction Clause, the Natural Born Citizen Clause. We know that came up recently. The 21st Amendment, the Third Amendment, the Bill of Attainder Clause, the Title of Nobility Clause, and the Letters of Marque and Reprisal Clause. So most of these things people have never heard of. But this is not just an academic exercise. You got into this odd clause business when you were in the Office of Legal Counsel under President Clinton. So something actually came up that was relevant?
That's right. I got the idea for the book. I worked at this office, which dealt with a lot of constitutional questions, and a lot of those questions involve clauses that you don't study in law school and you don't hear about in the news, clauses like the ones I write about in the book. And specifically, there was a day where my friend Ruby came running around and because somebody had asked her whether the titles of nobility clause prohibited Bill Clinton from accepting some sort of something from an African country. He was on his trip in Africa, and nobody had any idea what to do at the time. And I certainly had never heard of the titles of nobility clause, but I certainly thought it was interesting that there was such a thing. And it was that very day that I decided that someday, after I got tenure, I would write a book like this.
I'll bite. The titles of nobility clause is?
It's the clause that says that government officials cannot accept titles of nobility from foreign countries. And there's also a clause that there's another clause that says that the U.S. government can't confer a title of nobility on an American citizen.
So, listeners, if you have a question or a comment about any of these 10 odd clauses in the Constitution cited by law professor Jay Wexler in his new book, The Odd Clauses, Understanding the Constitution Through 10 of Its Most Curious Provisions, call us up. Or if you want to nominate some other clause of the Constitution for the 11th in the second edition, which is sure to come out someday, 212.
I have to do a sequel, you know.
Yes, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Let's talk about another one, the Recess Appointments Clause and what it says about presidential powers. You write that it's best to figure out what you think about how broadly or narrowly to interpret the Constitution. Recess appointments means the president can make appointments to his cabinet without going through the advice and consent of the Senate when they're out of session?
That's right. When the Senate is at recess, the president can appoint somebody who would otherwise have to be confirmed by the Senate. And so that's a sort of a way of getting your preferred controversial people into office without having to go through Senate confirmation. That was not the original intent, I think, of the clause, but rather it was meant to be kind of the harmless but important authority for the president to appoint somebody that they really needed to be there, like a Secretary of State or something. And if Congress wasn't around, and the president needed somebody in that position, this clause would give the president the authority to put someone in there at least until the Senate comes back.
So why wasn't it written as a 90-day appointment or something like that to not give away the Senate's authority under the separation of powers?
I don't know. I don't actually know the answer to that question. It's a good question. It's not a permanent appointment. The appointment does run out at the end of the session when the Senate comes back.
Ah.
So it's not permanent, but it is longer than 90 days usually. And
I see. So it's no more than 2 years,
right,
basically.
Exactly.
All right. Let's take another one. Let's see. You look at the Commerce Clause section on weights and measures in your book. And again, this is the Weights and Measures Clause. Who knew there was a Weights and Measures Clause in the Constitution?
It is. There is. When we think about why we don't have the metric system, that's a decision that's made by Congress. It's up to Congress to decide what our weights and measures are. And we've got a long history of debating whether we ought to have the metric system. There was a big, in the 70s, it was a big issue, and there was a board set up by Congress to consider whether we should have the metric system. And the board didn't do very much because there were a lot of people on the board who didn't think we should have the metric system. So they just argued a lot. And they turned out not to have done anything. But
did that revolve around some notion of American exceptionalism? Like the argument for going to the metric system was, oh, the rest of the world does it, so we might as well be able to weigh and measure things in the same language as everybody else. But then there were people who stood up and said, wait, this is the way we Americans do it, and we're not going to let the French tell us how to measure our gasoline.
We'll measure any way we want.
Is that what it was?
Well, I think that is a lot of it. And plus, of course, there's a lot of reliance. You know, we've grown up with our system, and we know our system, and why make a big change if we don't have to? But I think you're right. There is a lot of exceptionalism going on there. Although Myanmar, apparently, I think, also uses our system, so it's not like we're the only ones.
Unfortunately, I think we have a complete trade embargo with Myanmar, so it makes it hard to.
It's a real shame.
But that's in the Constitution?
Yes, it says Congress shall have the power to fix the weights and measures.
Oh, shall have the power to do
yes,
it. Okay.
Right.
Well, let's go on to another one. The Natural Born Citizen Clause. This is what came up with the birthers and President Obama, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. It's come up a number of times in our history. It came up with John McCain. There's actually a plausible argument. I think it's ultimately wrong, but a plausible argument that John McCain is not a natural born citizen for purposes of becoming president. But it is certainly the birther argument that's been made with President Obama.
Because McCain was born in the Panama Canal Zone.
Exactly.
Danny in Lambertville, you're on WNYC, and this is our first ever call on the Brian Lehrer Show about the title of nobility clause. A caller has never called up wanting to say something about the title of nobility clause before.
Yes.
So, Danny, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I find this really, really interesting. And basically, I was asking the question of since former mayor of New York, Giuliani, accepted the nobility title of knighthood from the Queen of England. How does even though he doesn't actually have himself called Sir, no one addresses him as Sir Rudolph Giuliani, how does that actually affect him since he did, in fact, accept the title?
Huh. Jay Wexler, do you know that to be true? Did he formally, officially accept being knighted in the UK?
I don't know the Giuliani specifics, but I do know that it would not violate the Constitution for him to accept such an honor from England, because he is not an officer of the United States when he accepted the title of nobility. So only officers of the United States are prohibited from accepting titles of nobility from foreign countries. And so we have a lot of people who've been knighted. Ted Kennedy was knighted.
Huh.
We have, you know, what's his name? Jerry Lewis is a member of the French Legion of Honor or something. And there are a lot of people who have been knighted.
But they don't work for the federal government,
exactly.
So it's okay under the Constitution.
Right. Now, there's a question
and
about
Norman. And we've confirmed, by the way, yes, Giuliani in 2002, just for the record. Go ahead.
Uh-huh. There is, in my book, I discuss the controversy over Norman Schwarzkopf, who did accept a title of nobility while he was an acting officer in the army. So there is an issue there about whether his title of nobility was constitutional, but the rest of them are fine.
Jay Wexler, Boston University law professor, with his new book, The Odd Clauses, Understanding the Constitution Through 10 of Its Most Curious Provisions, 212-433-WNYC. There's one in the Bill of Rights, the Third Amendment. Now, this is not one that comes up in the press very much. We say, oh, this is a violation of the First Amendment. You can't do it. What about the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms? But somehow we never wind up talking about the Third Amendment. Why not?
Because it works so well, I think. Nobody ever tries to, or the government never tries to quarter their troops in people's houses without their consent. But who knows what they would have done if there had been no Third Amendment. And one never knows in the future what could happen. There could be a possibility, a scenario you could imagine. I discussed them, one or two in the book, where all of a sudden it would make sense for the military to want to put its people, its soldiers, in private houses. And they won't
be
able to do
it. So wait, my brother-in-law who's in the Marines can't sleep over my house?
If you tell him he can't, I assume you're going to consent, but I don't really know.
But the point was in colonial times that Americans couldn't put up American military members, in the throes of battle?
Well, the concern was that the colonists had seen England, the English soldiers doing this and forcing American private homeowners to let English soldiers sleep in their house. And they thought, and that was one of the abuses that the colonists hated very much and led to the revolution. And so they didn't want that kind of scenario to ever happen again. And that's why they wrote the Third Amendment, to make sure that U.S. soldiers don't get quartered in U.S. private homes without the consent of the owners.
Ronald and in Red Bank on the Weights and Measures Clause. Hi, Ronald.
Hi. Professor, I was wondering if you could elaborate on the Weights and Measure Clause. Does it give the government the responsibility to determine that what we as citizens buy has a proper description for drugs, and if we were buying gold, if the gold wouldn't be debased?
It's a good question. It doesn't give the government the responsibility of doing that. It probably is one of the sources of power that the Constitution gives to Congress to allow it to do it. In other words, Congress could act and enact a law to ensure that what you're saying, that the measures are proper. And one of the sources of power would rely on is the Weights and Measures Clause. But I don't think there's any historical evidence or otherwise to suggest that the government is obligated to do that because of the Weights and Measures Clause.
I want to get to one more before we run out of time. It's the Bill of Attainder Clause. Also obscure to most people, but you link it to Guantanamo Bay, AIG, ACORN. That's a disparate bunch, but it sounds like an odd but significant clause.
It is a significant clause. It's maybe the least odd of all the clauses, depending on what your definition of odd is. But it's a really important clause. It's one of the only two civil liberties clauses that was included in the original Constitution, as opposed to the Bill of Rights. And it prohibits the legislature from imposing punishment on individuals or specifically described groups. In other words, the framers wanted to make sure that if somebody was punished, they were punished through a separation of power system where the legislature defined the crime and the executive enforced the crime and the judiciary adjudicated the crime. And they didn't like the idea that the legislature could simply impose a punishment on somebody. And the allegations have been, for example, in the ACORN case, that when Congress defunded them, this came up with Planned Parenthood for a minute, too, that the legislature was, in fact, imposing a punishment on the organization for its bad behavior.
And real quick, the original jurisdiction clause, which I gather gives power to the Supreme Court to decide all state-to-state boundary disputes. So that applies to whether Ellis Island was in New York or New Jersey?
Exactly. That's the most, I think, prominent original jurisdiction case of recent years. It's something that few people know, I think, that when a state wants to sue another state, there's nowhere for it to bring that case. Mm-hmm. That would be kind of an objective forum. And the framers knew that that was going to be the case, and so they provided that the Supreme Court would hear those cases. And so if New York wants to sue New Jersey, it goes right to the Supreme Court. And it turns out that New Jersey owned Ellis Island.
New Jersey owns Ellis Island. In our last 20 seconds, is this just for fun that you're pointing out these odd clauses of the Constitution, or do you think there's something at stake?
I think there's something at stake. I started off writing the book because I thought it was fun, but as I started writing it, I realized that there's a lot of important stuff that goes on with these clauses. Even if they don't make the news, even if they're not litigated, they sort of provide the constitutional backdrop for how our democracy works. Right. And if we're going to understand the Constitution, we have to understand all of it.
Jay Wexler, author of The Odd Clauses, Understanding the Constitution Through 10 of Its Most Curious Provisions. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.